My name is Bill Erbrock from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. This is the last in a series of five sessions that we've had this week on silence, solitude, and self-renewal. And we've been starting and ending each of the sessions with three or four of these illustrated aphorisms. The aphorisms by Bernard Gunther, and I'm sure many of you already recognize the illustrator, Mary Karita. Known to some of you as Sister Mary Karita, to others perhaps as Karita Kent or Mary Karita Kent. And the topic for today is freedom and love, consequences of prayer. For people who are listening on the tape, the first one here says, don't get stuck in your glue me, G-L-U-E. This is sort of a doggerel poem. No system has a copyright on the pure white light. I'm going to leave this one up here just for a minute or two. It's one of my favorites, Love Ascending You. We've lost the shade again. Any of you have any, before I go on, do any of you have any immediate reactions to this one?
I have a reaction to that. That's an unusual Karita.
An unusual Karita.
Because I think she doesn't use pastels like as much as that seems to me, and that the edges here are sort of fuzzy, and it's, but I don't know her artwork that well, but it seems to me that the other two are much more typical.
Those black and white, with those real stark,
zen-like
strokes, very similar to some of the strokes that Thomas Merton has, if you ever looked at some of his work that appears in A Hidden Wholeness, or in a couple of his other late works that he did. I don't know if I can find them here right away. You might want to pass these around. Start with this photo, and then it's about the next four or five pages. You'll see some of Thomas Merton's. Anybody make any kind of a connection with this in any way? Is this a good painting to you, or does it leave you cold? Is it peaceful? I've looked at this painting ever so many times, and it's the first time that I had a sense of waves sort of beating up against a shore.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that several of you have been here all week, and I hope you at least have had some small sense that it is possible to use these sorts of slides like mantras. You wouldn't want to use them in as quick a succession as I've been showing them perforce because of our time limits here. But these sorts of things, it seems to me, could be very nicely used for private prayer, for sort of long-term meditation. And if one wanted to, there would be no reason why one couldn't, you know, put them in a certain order for oneself and kind of work them through. At least one other person in the room here, Tim, has had a set of the cards from which these slides originally come. But other things like this could certainly be used. Well, I'll leave that on just for a minute while I say a few words of introduction, and then when we get into the heart of today's matter, I think I'll turn that off and bring up the lights for a little while. I also don't know whether any of the articles are still going around. I had about 14 Xeroxed articles which were moving around through people who had been here, and I've got two at this point, so there's a dozen of them someplace. I don't know where they are. But can I see how many of you have been to none of the sessions this week? All right, that's most of you. So let me give you a brief overview of what we've done. The first day we spent on solitude and entitled the session Choosing Solitude and talked somewhat about how one really needs to set a discipline, especially in the modern world, most of us, if we're going to find times of solitude. And we also talked about the two faces of being alone, in Paul Tillich's words. The pain of being alone felt as loneliness, and the glory of being alone experienced as solitude. And the second day we spent a good deal of time talking about silence. We also remained silent for a while. We did a little practicing as we were watching the Karita slides. But we also looked at two sides of silence, the kind of silence that can cut you off from people or that others will use to cut you off, a distancing silence, a stubborn silence, a menacing silence, and also God being felt in that way by many people, and particularly in our modern age. And we talked a little about Tillich and his statements about how many modern people experience the absence of God, and that if one has that experience, one should not immediately think that there's something wrong with oneself. It may very well be that God, for whatever reason, chooses to be absent. And there are times when the Spirit of God chooses to be absent. And if we recognize that and recognize the times when God is absent from us and silent to our cries, as it were, perhaps that would give us a greater empathy and a greater sense of solidarity with others that we know who experience the absence of God. And it isn't always that easy to sort of just put God into their lives. So we're talking about that kind of silence, the sort of thing that the psalmist says, how long, O Lord, aren't you going to answer me? That sort of a thing, or the book of Job. But then we talked about another kind of silence, a silence that we seek, and a silence that many of us really wish we could cultivate a little bit more. Just like that other face of loneliness, which is solitude. There is that sort of silence in the presence of God when all the earth remains silent, as it were. There is the silence that we can give to each other as gifts. When a hurt may be so great that the best thing you can say is nothing and just be there. There are silences that are incredibly comforting. There are silences that are very accepting. And especially in our noisy world, many of us wish we could find more silence. The third session we spent talking about how both solitude and silence can be cultivated as preparation for deepening our prayer, our life of prayer, and our sense of prayer. Especially since we are so used to using words all the time in our prayers. And we looked at a wonderful chapter, I did for you, since the books were not around here, but a chapter in this book by Francis Vanderwall. The book is entitled Water in the Wilderness, Paths of Prayer, Springs of Life, a chapter on varieties of prayer, in which Vanderwall talks not only about the usual kinds of praying that we're acquainted with, particularly spoken prayer and prayer in groups and intercessory prayer and so forth. But he also talks about more contemplative kinds of praying and unusual sorts of praying, praying with your dreams, praying with your imagination and your fantasies, cultivating simple quiet and self-awareness that can finally, as Tim said for us, kind of center you down. Was that what you said? Kind of center you down. And that kind of prayer, which really doesn't need to go anywhere. And we talked about that perhaps at its basis, prayer finally is getting to that quiet state where we're simply receptive and open and ready to listen. Whereas most of the times, most of us seem to think that prayer needs to be saying all kinds of things and getting it all out there for God to hear, as if God didn't know. And I pointed to what I at least consider to be kind of the paradigm of the ultimate in prayer, which was the prayer of Christ in the garden, where he emptied himself out, as it were, and simply said, "Well, your will be done." That's receptivity, simply to be receptive, to be waiting upon God to speak, whether God is felt to be present or whether God is felt to be absent. And yesterday, we talked a little bit about another pair, as it were, like we did with the loneliness and solitude and the noise and silence, or the two faces of silence, too. Talk a little bit about emptiness and fullness. And I used as an example what I consider to be a really striking passage out of a favorite novel of mine, maybe some of you know it, Hermann Hesse's novel Siddhartha. Has anybody here who's read Siddhartha? Oh, great. Nobody had yesterday. Today we have a few people who know it. I think it's just a wonderful book. I recommend it especially for young people. But it's a great book when you get into your second childhood problematic in your mid-40s. It's a fine book around that time again, I think. It's the story of a young man who goes through just about everything in life on his way towards becoming a Buddha, as it were. Because, of course, that's the whole point of Buddhism, for every person to become enlightened. And I suggested that that's also a Christian process, because the opening chapter of John indicates that those who have been in touch with the God who's emptied himself in the incarnation have received of a fullness. Of his fullness, all of us have received, John writes, grace upon grace. And so my suggestion was that though fullness and emptiness appear to be great opposites, and it wasn't only my suggestion, because then many, many people began to share in the group, that often when you appear the fullest, you may actually be the emptiest. And sometimes those who appear to be the most empty really are the most full. And so there's also a sort of a convergence, I think, in the practice of prayer in Christianity and the practice of prayer in Buddhism, because in Buddhism the aim is to become empty. It's for shunya. But of course the emptiness is so that the Buddha nature can shine forth, as it were. In Christianity we seem to always aim towards fullness. Our aim is for heaven, for the pleroma, the fullness. And yet you don't get to that fullness, at least not in the Christian pathway, except by a self-emptying. Easter only comes after Good Friday. It's a cliche, but it's something that evidently needs to be said over and over, because it always comes as such a surprise to us. And we were talking yesterday about some of our experiences of being empty and how some people have helped to refill us. And we also talked about some times when maybe we thought we didn't have anything to offer and suddenly found all these resources. Well, all of this, of course, has been skirting in one way or another, or touching into one way or another, the whole issue of our deepening our prayer life, deepening our spiritual connection, as it were, to that which is ultimate, or that which centers us, that which holds us together. I want to start today also the way I did in the other sessions, with you at least, and that is to put a question and to see if I can get a few responses. And the question would be this. Topic today is freedom and love as consequences of prayer. So the question, can we identify some of the things that hold us in bondage, that appear to hold us back from real freedom? Or as Van der Waal puts it, can we identify some of our unfreedoms? It may be that you can and you don't want to share, but if you're willing to, it would be a gift for us if you could.
Are you speaking of the law?
Well, I'm asking you. What in our lives appears to be holding us back from being what we really ought to be?
Resentment.
Someone says resentment. You feel that resentments can get a hold on you sometimes and really just hold you back from being who you are and who you'd like to be. Yes?
Too busy a time schedule. Feel too frantic, can't settle down.
So become enslaved to a schedule. Enslaved to a clock. I appreciate that one because I feel that very often. You feel that the clock is controlling you and the schedule is controlling you rather than vice versa.
Anyone else?
That one's tied for me to one that if I don't rush so fast, I'm going to wind up in some place I don't want to be. Some out of it kind of environment, which is really crummy, that I wouldn't like at all. So I feel if I really relax, I'd be in some terrible place or something. Maybe it wouldn't be that terrible after me.
You're on a treadmill, kid?
It's my neighbor. Thanks.
To be caught up in a myriad of little details that at the time don't seem to have any relevancy to what I really think I should be doing or what I could be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then in retrospect, later, finding that some of those minute details didn't really contribute. It was frustrating trying to take care of them.
So there's a double face again. Sometimes those minute details get in the way, and yet every once in a while you're surprised that some of them actually have opened up towards something much more important for you. I expect that had we been in, you know, a session with Steve and Marion this week, they certainly wouldn't have had any trouble speaking about certain things that hold black Africans back from full freedom, and they would have pointed towards political sorts of realities, economic kinds of realities, international sorts of relations, which have a way of weaving a web that comes right down into the lives of people, so much so that, you know, they have no decent livelihood, they can have very little self-respect, or if they do have self-respect, it's a major battle to have it. And those are certainly, for many of us, it seems to me that for many of us, those are real sources of, can you say sources of limitation? Real limits on our freedoms, economic, political realities of one sort or another.
I'd say preconceived notions about what a person is or should be, or the church is or should be. I mean, it seems to me those are incredibly limiting.
Mm-hmm. We have a beautiful Seder that we use at home. We've been using a Passover Seder at our home for about the last 20 years now. Usually try to invite some friends in to celebrate with us. And it's our own revised version, as it were, in some ways. But it's not, we don't put any Christian sort of stuff in there. We want it to be truly a Jewish Passover. But I found some modern Seders. You're aware that there are a lot of updatings, you know. And we say these verses at the beginning about, you know, who are those that are in bondage today? And we read those around the table. And this is one that's in there. People who are in bondage to their own fears, their own prejudices, their own preconceived notions. And I don't know that that leaves any of us out.
No, I don't think so.
Is there one particular one that we could put a finger on? It would seem to me that if one were to deepen one's prayer life, one would have to do that. If you want to pray maybe over your resentments. Well, if you're going to do that, I suppose you'd have to identify a person that you feel a lot of resentment against. Van der Waal has one of these exercises in here. It's either he or DeMello. That other book that I was suggesting that's in the library here, where you fantasize the other person that you have these resentments against. If you're not at the point where you're courageous enough or mellow enough to go to the person, and you have the person there, and you just start laying it all on that person. You know, all the awful things that you need to say.
That's DeMello.
Huh? That's DeMello. That's in his book, Sadhana.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Van der Waal refers to him. But it's in DeMello's book. And he says you do all this fantasizing and kind of work out as much as you can, and then what you have to do is do what I do down here. You click the slide, and then the next slide is supposed to be, you know, Christ saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Crucifixion kind of a slide. And you kind of stick with that for a while, and if there's still an awful lot more junk inside of you, you just click this, you just do a reverse on the slide, and you go back to this person and just lay it all on them again. And you keep clicking back and forth until such a time as the, you know, the Christian message, the word, has its way with you. Of course, that, again, I would assume would not be the end of your prayer, because you still haven't gotten to the point where you've, you know, having something against this brother or sister, that you've gone to meet him or her before you lay your gift at the altar. But I imagine we'd have to do that, or we could do that, with some of our prejudices, if we were able to really identify one or another of them, and maybe just fantasize how that's been holding us back. Or fantasize, if I got rid of that, what would happen? And those are ways sometimes of deflating certain things that have a hold over us. Well, you know, in the old days, they used to call these devils or demons. These are the demons that have hold of us. Most of us don't tend to talk that way now anymore, about demons having a hold on us, the demon of jealousy or the demon of prejudice. Or most of us don't call, you know, some of our economic systems that are out there nowadays demonic. Maybe we should. But these are, in the old time talk, the kinds of demons that have a hold on us. Van der Waal, in this book, talks about family sorts of things, relationships in families that for many, many people are demonic. And that instead of being a source for cultivating freedom and love, do just the opposite. They put people into cages, and they feel like they don't have the ability really to reach out in love. He talks about organized religion as being a major source of unfreedom for many people. And he says, I realize readers are going to be, some of my readers will be surprised as they follow this through, but then he says, just think of it. Think of how sometimes it becomes such a way that you become so worried about doing the right thing, or you feel you can't make an ecumenical gesture until your synod says you can. Now, where's the freedom there? It's actually become a bondage rather than a freedom. Well, and there may be many other things that you can think of as well. And then, of course, he talks about politics, government, economics, and so forth. And another major one that he mentions is, especially under economics, is the one that Jesus identified. You can't serve two masters. You're going to either love one and hate the other, or vice versa. You can't serve both God and money. And I think that's a major demon, certainly for me. And it may well be a major demon for many others as well. I wanted to read you something from Van der Waal, which was a rather neat story, I felt. Once I knew of an old lady, the wife of a sharecropper, who had led a life of constant prayer. She was now almost destitute, had lived alone, and in enforced solitude, since her husband's premature death, and was in failing health. Yet she was a memorable example of the perspective that prayer can provide upon one's economic state. Her constant refrain was how good God was, how fortunate her life had been, what a loving husband she had had, what fine children who had given her so little trouble as they grew up. She always would say, God will provide, God will provide, whenever she dipped into her almost empty bank drawer. She would find so little in there that her next meal seemed to be an uncertain thing. But of course, the amazing thing was that God always did provide. She never went hungry. She would always be able to scrape up enough to find another meal. And that wasn't all. At her age, and in the economic strait she was in, one would expect her to be preoccupied with making her own ends meet. Not at all. Hers was a busy life. She was constantly caring for the poor and the sick, as she would say. She would run errands for them, pick up their mail from the rural post office and deliver it to them, work in all the charitable functions at her church, help raise money for the poor, and generally be a most loving neighbor to others. Hers was a busy life indeed, and rare were the times she would complain except when her arthritis got the better of her. which, as she would say, kept me from helping those who need me. Actually, as I could see it, there was much more wrong with her than her arthritis. But her other ailments she simply didn't complain about, and so one would never know. In the midst of her busy life and economic destitution, she was happy. If you go back to our topic yesterday, you know, ever so many people might say, oh my God, you know, empty, there's nothing there. And yet she was a person who was full, as Van der Waal describes her. And so he then says, whenever I spent time with her, I always felt my own heart cheered. She forced a new perspective on me in a way that was refreshing and challenging. For what she exemplified was Christ's injunction not to worry about clothing and food and drink, but rather to set one's heart on the kingdom, and then all these other things will be given to you as well. The truth of the matter was that these words became fulfilled in her life daily. Somehow, in some way, she would find the money to live and to live contentedly. And people who knew her were always surprised at how well she did. She, however, never was surprised. She took it for granted, and with a chuckle that lit up her face would always say, God provides. Well, clearly there's an example of a person who had found freedom and a way to love in a situation that many of us might think, you know, would have hampered her so much and not given her much of an ability to love. But I think the secret was, at the beginning he said, that she had a very rich prayer life. And she had cultivated that, you know, that sense of centering, as Tim might say, or as I like to say, being in touch. I brought one other example of a person that I've learned a lot from, and it's someone that I don't think many people know, and so I wanted to introduce him to you and suggest that if you're ever in a library and can find something about John Woolman, that you do so. This is a book that I found one time in a used bookstore. I don't think it's in print anymore. I wrote ahead to Holden and said, if you can find anything on John Woolman or his journal, put a few copies in, and I noticed there's nothing here, so I have no idea what's out there right now. This is the Journal of John Woolman, W-O-O-L-M-A-N, along with a letter that he once wrote called A Plea for the Poor. Woolman was an early American Quaker. He lived from 1720 to 1772, so he died just in the years before the Revolution. And it's a wonderful journal that he writes, which covers many years of his life. In fact, when he started the journal, he tries to remember back into his childhood, so he has some entries that kind of, you know, tell about how he was growing up. And then he has regular entries in that journal that follow for several years. And I was struck by it because, being a friend, of course, he followed a very simple life. He was a very serious Quaker, and so his life was one of, appeared in many ways to be emptiness. He did not have many of the things that most of us would consider necessary to a good life. He was certainly a person who cultivated solitude. He talks about it many times in the journal. And he was well acquainted with silence, even with liturgical silence in Quaker meeting. And several times, as you read in the journal, he will describe how he wanted to say something in meeting and then would pull back because he wasn't really sure whether that was the Spirit of God moving him or whether he wasn't maybe just being a little proud because he just had a good insight. And some of you who are teachers will recognize that that is a tremendous danger that all of us teachers have, and it's one that I'm always painfully aware of. And even when I'm aware of it, I can't always overcome it. you always want to say things, and you always want to have the last word and be the final didactic corrector in a group and all that. It's really difficult to discipline yourself to listen. It gets easier the more you listen because you hear so many good things. But, you know, to imagine what would happen in some of our churches if we might do this once in a while. I mean, not just have 2 minutes of silence in a church service, but just have the whole service that way. This Sunday, we're going to come together in silence. We'll throw one Mary Carita slide up on the sanctuary wall for you. It's going to say, "Love ascending you," and that's it.
When would you take the offering?
Well, you probably wouldn't that Sunday. You'd trust people to bring a double one the next week, or to send it in. But you know, the kind of nervousness that we often have in silence, and yet I've had the experience in some groups where after you get over that original nervousness and you really start sitting in silence, you do have a sense that the silence is so sacred and there's so much going on in that silence that you only interrupt it with great fear and trembling unless you really feel that something is moving you to share a word, because there are all kinds of words being shared. The other side of Woolman is, of course, that he, to me at least, exemplifies both freedom and love as consequences of this cultivated life of solitude and silence. Because Woolman became, well, he actually was, he was the first outspoken critic of slavery in the colonies. Outspoken in the sense that he felt compelled to visit many friends' meetings and to speak about this. He even felt compelled, against many misgivings of his own, to get his own chapter of friends, to get a circular letter written around. And he spoke about slavery not only in the colonies, but even when he went to England on a trip at one time. So I'm sure there were other critics of slavery, but I say, to my mind, he was the first really outspoken and important critic of slavery, because he did it publicly, and he did it in many places. And the first, I want to read you the first couple of times that he had this movement, that he had to do this. I just thought it was so striking, and I wanted to share it with you. He was in the habit of drawing up wills for people, because he could read and write. Of course, not everybody could. And so friends would often call him in to write their will for them. I don't know whether he was also a notary public of sorts. But this is in 1753, so he was 33 years old at this time. And he says, "At this time, a person at some distance lying sick, his brother came to me to write his will. I knew he had slaves, and asking his brother, was told he intended to leave them as slaves to his children." So he's going to pass them down as part of the family property. "As writing is a profitable employ, and as offending sober people was disagreeable to my inclination, I was much straitened in my mind." He was in straits. "But as I looked to the Lord, he inclined my heart to his testimony. So I told the man that I believed the practice of continuing slavery to this people was not right, and that I had a scruple in my mind against doing writings of that kind, and that though many in our society kept them as slaves, still I was not easy to be concerned in it, and desired to be excused from going to write the will. I spake to him in the fear of the Lord, and he made no reply to what I said, but went away. He also had some concerns in the practice, but I thought he was displeased with me. So in this case I had fresh confirmation that acting contrary to present outward interest from a motive of divine love and in regard to truth and righteousness, and thereby incurring the resentments of people, may nevertheless open the way to a treasure better than silver and to a friendship exceeding the friendship of men. Then there's another occasion. Now he's talking about yet another person. He says, near the time that the last mentioned friend first spoke to me, a neighbor received a bad bruise in his body and sent for me to bleed him, which having done, he desired me to write his will. I took notes, and amongst other things, he told me to which of his children he was giving his young Negro. I considered the pain and the distress that he was in, and I knew not how it would end, so I did go ahead to write his will, save only that part concerning his slave. And carrying it to his bedside, I read it to him. I then told him in a friendly way that I could not write any instruments by which my fellow creatures were made slaves without bringing trouble on my own mind. I let him know that I charged nothing for what I had done and desired to be excused from doing the other part in the way he proposed. We then had a very serious conference on the subject. At length, he agreeing to set her free and I finishing his will. Well, there are other stories like this in his journal. He has a wonderful story in there about one time when he went to someone's home for supper and they had all this pewter tableware, and he was much straightened in his mind again because he felt it was too fancy. And so he was trying to think up these excuses, these nice excuses, to get out of dinner, and he finally decided it was the better part of you know, brotherly love to eat, even though his conscience was just burdening him through the whole dinner. And then there's another one in there where he got very burdened because of some of the friends who were buying fancier clothes, or the friends were supposed to also dress very plainly. And some of them were getting fancy hats. And this distressed him. He also was moved to make visits to various Native American groups. And so he went on little missionary journeys and was invited in many of these villages. And there are wonderful stories about how sometimes there were rival preachers. There would be a Moravian there, and he was there. And the Native Americans would go to listen to one day and another the next day. And then sometimes the two of them would have a debate while all of the natives were listening in. But, you know, he always writes with this wonderful equanimity and magnanimity. And even where there's argument, you feel like, you know, his typical Quaker, he's looking for consensus all the time. And you really have the sense of a person who, you know, we would say, well, that's an unfreedom. He shouldn't worry about fancy clothes and fancy pewter stuff. I mean, why is he worried about that? And others of his day might have said, why is he worried about a black person? They're not persons anyway. And yet, out of his cultivation of silence and solitude and prayer, and in the kind of slavery that he knew, namely giving his whole personality in slavery to God, as it were, he discovered the freedom, you know, to speak in situations like this. And then he also discovered the way to make that winsome. I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm not going to write your whole will, because I don't like the fact that you're having slaves. It's another to say, I can't write the whole thing, so as much as I can write, I won't charge. There's already a movement there that is not only a movement of his own freedom in the situation, but it's a movement of love towards the other, and a sense, can I bring you over? Can I heal you and have you see something else? So I recommend this book to you. If you're ever browsing in an old bookstore and you come across an old copy, see, look for the journal of John Woolman. Also, there's this wonderful writing in here on a plea for the poor. It's one of the most powerful pieces I think I've read about wealth and poverty, and about how in his day at least, he saw the wealthy oppressing the poor. And again, a signal that the kind of prayer life that he cultivated, you know, gave him the freedom to reach out in a kind of love that could also critique. When
it, well, it seems yeah. to me that we're always that things that would prevent, that would be unfreedoms or prevent us from experiencing freedom are most often perceived as being things that are from the outside over against our freedom. And it's difficult for me to imagine what it would take to be made aware of something within yourself that's creating mm-hmm. this blockage. I mean, one can always see the problem in somebody else much easier. So that that you try to figure out, as Woolman did, how to figure out ways of saying to them, slavery is wrong, and you're doing such and so mm-hmm. and such. It's quite another thing to say, or a friend whose tastes run to excess, and your own sensibilities are that a simpler lifestyle would be better for that person, and also better for you, so that you didn't have to keep up with them. Quite another thing to be able to have your eyes open about that which keeps you yourself from freedom.
I think that all of these, I talked the other day about the great athletes in prayer. I mean, there are some people that were great athletes in prayer. Merton clearly was. Woolman probably was. I would imagine that Mother Teresa is a great athlete in prayer, besides all the rest that she does. The final word that they give is that you don't cultivate solitude just for the sake of solitude. You cultivate solitude so that you may be sort of refreshed to re-enter the community. Or even more than that, to discover a community at a deeper level than you thought. It's the same thing. You don't cultivate silence merely to cultivate the silence. The point is to get rid of all the other noise that blocks out the real word from getting through. Now, Merton talks about this. The silence is there finally for the sake of that real word. But without the silence, that word is never really created. It's never really heard. It's just like great music. Great music depends as much upon the silences in the music as it does on the sound. Or beautiful words of love. You have to have some time after that to just silently let that sink in. That's why you and I are so jarred so often when we watch TV. And you see this moving scene and Skippy peanut butter, The scene isn't even over, and it's cutting you over. And wait a minute, where is this? Where is the quiet silence that this can now sink into? Or it's the same the other way. You have this noisy commercial for Mr. Clean, and immediately they're right back into it again. Where's that nice, pregnant, beginning, quiet silence so you can get into it? We do this in the theater. The lights go down slowly. You have a little music. You get yourself gathered. But the silence is there so that you can really hear the word. And the solitude is there so that you can be refreshed in community. And I think, the best I have for an answer is that you and I are dependent upon someone else who will gift us the way Woolman gifted that other person, by coming to the person and bringing the gift by giving the word to him. Because I do think it's very difficult for us to see many of these things about ourselves. Although I think we can see some of them as we cultivate greater self-awareness. But for the rest, we're thrown back into community. And so finally, the real emphasis in a prayer life, in cultivating silence, solitude, whatever you want to call it, is finally so that fullness that Christ talked about, where you discover that freedom to love God completely and to love the neighbor completely, because you're also loving yourself completely. And you've sort of discovered, in the words of Kuza, which I like so much, that medieval bishop, that God is a circle whose circumference is nowhere. It means there can be nothing outside of God and God's care, and whose center is everywhere. And that means, you know, it's possible when you get in touch at the center to be in touch with other people's center as well. Because all are centered in the one.